The line of prophecy that I'm trying to address over the past few presentations are the verses in Daniel 11, from verses 11 to 15, verse 16 representing the Sunday law, verse 11 representing the Ukraine war that's going on right now. One of the starting points for this understanding is that in the beginning and the ending of the book of Revelation, there is a reference to the unsealing of the revelation of Jesus Christ, for the time is at hand, in the first three verses of Revelation chapter 1. And then in Revelation 22, verses 9 and 10, I believe, at the end of Revelation, there's a pronouncement to seal not the sayings of the prophecies of this book, for the time is at hand. And then the next verse is the close of probation, where the pronouncement is made, he that is unjust, let him be unjust still. And Sister White, we use a quote here from Sister White that says that portion of the prophecy that was sealed was that portion of the prophecy that of Daniel that related to the latter days. So the books of Daniel and Revelation being one book, the prophecy that gets unsealed in the latter days is a combination of truths that are found in Daniel and Revelation. And the portion of the prophecy of Daniel that relates to the last days that is unsealed is found in Daniel 11, verse 40. Because in Daniel 11, verse 40, you have the time, it begins at the time of the end in 1798 with a war between the king of the north and the king of the south, as atheistic France, the king of the south, delivers the deadly wound to the papacy, the king of the north. But by the end of that verse, the papacy, the king of the north, has come with its allies, the United States, represented as chariots, ships, and horsemen. And they sweep away the modern king of the South, the king of atheism, which at that time is the Soviet Union, and they leave Russia standing. But the point I'm getting to here is that in verse 40 itself, it leads you to 1989, and then the next verse, verse 41, is the Sunday law in the United States. So from 1989 until the Sunday law, the history that's in verse 40 is silent. It's dark, however you want to portray it for yourself. Verse 40 takes you to 1989 and it stops. And verse 41 is the Sunday law. So there's a period of history that isn't specifically addressed in verse 40. And I'm saying that in Daniel chapter 11, verse 1 and 2, and then verses 11 through 15 are passages from the book of Daniel that fit into that hidden history, as I like to call it. Verses 1 and 2 identifies Darius and Cyrus, the first two kings of the Medo-Persian Empire, and it points to 1989 with Ronald Reagan and George Bush the elder, and it gives us the sequence that after George Bush the elder, the first, there would be three kings that would yet stand up, that being Clinton, Bush the second, the younger, Obama, and then the fourth king would be Trump, the richest of them all. And verse two ends there. It introduces Donald Trump as the sixth president since the time of the end in 1989. And it identifies that he stirs up all the realm of Gratia. Gratia is a symbol of the world. And anyone that's been awake since Trump announced he was going to run in 2015 realizes that the globalists in the United States and the globalists outside of the United States were awakened, they were stirred up. And that's the definition of the word stirred up there in verse two. They were awakened by Trump being introduced into history. And that ends there. It takes you to, it introduces you to 1989, which is the where the testimony in verse 40 ends. And then it takes you to Donald Trump but it doesn't take you all the way to the end of Donald Trump. It just introduces you to the fact that he was going to stir up all the realm of Grecia. But in verse 10, you are brought back to 1989 because the history that fulfilled verse 10 of Daniel 11 illustrates the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, when the King of the North, which in 1989 was the papacy in the United States, taking out the Soviet Union, but leaving Russia. And Russia there in verse 10 is the fortress. This ties in with the symbol in Isaiah 7 of a head being the capital, being the king, the kingdom, the capital of the kingdom, and the head that was left when the Soviet Union collapsed in verse 10 of Daniel 11 was Russia. And this is your point of reference to show that this verses 11 and 12 is this war that Russia carries out in retaliation for what happened in 1989, and they prevail. Putin's going to prevail. And if you notice, yesterday was the first time Russia officially called their war with Ukraine a war. Before that, it was some kind of military, a special operations, but they began to call it a war now, and they began to take out their communication and their power transmissions the way you would expect something to happen in a modern war. So this war is progressing, and the history that fulfilled verses 11 and 12 instructs us that Putin would win the war, but he's not going to be benefited by his victory, and he's going to very quickly come to his demise, and he's going to Russia's going to be left as a weakened vessel. And according to the history that was fulfilled when Ptolemy accomplished the fulfillment of verses 11 and 12 in Daniel 11, two powers were going to get together to try to take control of his kingdom. The Seleucids and the Macedonians, which would be in our history, the United States, the United Nations, the Army of the United States, the Army of NATO, they're going to want to seize upon the disarray that's going on in Russia, divide up whatever they can politically for one another. And that brings you, that's verse 13 is talking about this desire of these kings to take advantage of a weakened Egyptian child king. That's what fulfilled verse 12. But I'm saying that it's a weakened Russia, even though they defeat Ukraine. And before they really get opportunity to, in the history of verse 14, the papacy inserts itself into history in a profound way. In antiquity, when this was fulfilled, it was Rome taking the Egyptian child king as to protect it and holding off these two allies that were going to divide up its kingdom. And then in verse 15, you have the Battle of Panium. And the Battle of Panium is the same town that Jesus went to right before he was going to the cross, called Caesarea Philippi. And the point of this presentation isn't so much to deal with Matthew 16 and 17, Caesarea Philippi and the Mount of Transfiguration, that was also connected with Caesarea Philippi, but it's to lay out the history of verses 13 to 15, actually verses 13 through 23, if you get technical, in order to see what we should expect the waymarks are in the history immediately after the Ukraine war is finalized. So what I have here in your notes is the history of verses 13 to 23, and I'll explain why I go all the way to 23 once we get started. But Uriah Smith will tell you that verse 23 was the league with the Jews and the Romans in the year 161. So it goes back into history. What I mean by going back into history is that, well, let's walk through our notes, if you have them, not with reading what's in the notes, but by allowing me to use the subtitles to lay out the history. The Battle of Raphia, which I'm saying is the Ukraine war at this time, took place in 217 BC. You'll see that in your notes. And after Ptolemy was victorious there in verses 11 and 12, then he drinks himself to death, parties down, he dies, and he leaves the kingdom to this 4 or 5 year old Egyptian child. And in the year 200 BC, pagan Rome comes into history. And if just out of a, I don't know if this has a bearing on the study or not, Uriah Smith correctly teaches that this is where pagan Rome comes into history, but Uriah Smith very strongly teaches in the same book, and it's more of an emphasis, that the rule of Bible prophecy is that a power is not mentioned until it comes into contact with God's people. And Uriah Smith notes that pagan Rome inserted into prophetic history here in the year 200 in verse 14 of Daniel 11, when it was going to protect this Egyptian child king. But he doesn't identify that as the first introduction of Rome. Later on, when Rome forms the league with the Jews, that's when he says the first time Rome comes into the prophecy. So there's kind of a contradiction in Uriah Smith's application. I don't know that it means anything worth, you know, worrying about, but I'm pointing it out to you because I'm going to try to get you to see the flow of history that I'm going to suggest illustrates the flow of history that leads up to the Sunday law. And in so doing, I'm going to say it's the flow of history that parallels with Christ's visit to Caesarea Philippi with the disciples and thereafter with the Mount of Transfiguration, and that it is the preeminent testimony on the hidden history of verse 40 of Daniel 11, and that it is the history, the prophetic message that is designed by the line of the tribe of Judah to impress the seal upon the 144,000 just before the Sunday law. So I'm suggesting it's really serious information. And I first want to just get you to see, if you will, the sequence of events. The Battle of Raphia in verse 10 was 217 BC. And then in verse 14, pagan Rome intercedes into history in the year 200 BC to protect this child king. And then 2 years later in 198, you have the Battle of Panium. And the Battle of Panium was not between the king of the north and the king of the south. And I know that Sister Alla has pointed out correctly that as I'm talking about these three battles, verse 10, 1989, verse 11, the Battle of Raphia, verse 15, the Battle of Panium, I've been calling them the three battles of the Cold War, and the expression Cold War is not so accurate, but I want to make a distinction between these battles and the Third World War that begins at the Sunday law. So I selected that for that reason, and also because you can show how the papacy was using proxy armies during these battles represented in verse 10, verse 11, and verse 15. But verse 15, the antagonists, the enemies in the battle are apostate Jews called the Maccabees and the Greeks. The Seleucid Empire, And I'm calling them apostate Jews on purpose. And I believe that I'm absolutely correct. And I believe they have to be understood that way because they are the symbol of apostate Protestantism in the history that we're living in. And they were not very, there is not any very many direct references to them in Daniel 11. But that's part of the message, is that once you go through and look at the story of the Maccabees, you find that it is a line that lays over this history that we're considering. And it's sort of a hidden line, the way that verse 40 has this hidden history. And it's one of those lines that the line of the tribe of Judah is unsealing for his own purposes at this time. And I think you'll see what I mean as we proceed. The first battle between the Maccabees, and the historians call the Maccabees the Hasmonean dynasty, okay? And the Maccabees, these Jewish zealots, they win the Battle of Panaim. And their motivation, their logic for being in a war with Greece wasn't political or territorial. It was they were defending against the intrusion of the Greek religion and the forced religious worship of the Greeks upon the Jews. In your notes on page 2, you'll see 167 BC. And 167 BC is what they call the Maccabean Revolt. And what you need to notice, if you're going to keep it clear in your head, or at least I needed to, is that the first battle of the Maccabees against the Greek culture, the Seleucid Empire, was in the year 198, and it was the Battle of Panaim. But when you go into history, you'll find that in 167 BC, which would be whatever that would be, 22 years, is it 32 years later? 67 from 98 to, anyway, whatever it is, I can't do the math in my head. I'll do it though. 67, 98, 3, 31 years after the Battle of Panaim, there is a battle that the Maccabees prevail in, that they bring about, and it's what the historians identify as the beginning of the Maccabean Revolt. They revolted. This is where they are marked as fully opposing the Greek intrusion of the Greek religion into the Hebrew culture, even though they'd already been at war with them. 167 is where this is marked. And that is 3 years before, I'm on page 3 now, the date of 164 BC. And 164 BC is the date that is noted by Judaism as that they celebrate and commemorate Hanukkah. Okay, and Hanukkah was when they finally reached the point where they had driven the Greeks out of the control of Jerusalem to the point that they could rededicate the temple, and they rededicated the temple, and they only had oil for one day. And miraculously, the oil, the temple, the holy temple oil lasted for 8 days, and they commemorate that. And that came 3 years after this Battle of Modin, which was 167, which they mark the beginning of the Maccabean Revolt as. And I'll say right here, and I'll probably say it more than once, it doesn't matter that the Jewish religion observes Hanukkah and identifies it as a miraculous event in their history where God worked for them to rededicate the temple. It doesn't matter the claims that they're making about it. if that really happened, if the oil really did, that one day's worth of oil lasts for 8 days, the best you can say about it is it was a satanic miracle. And I'll give my evidence for that afterwards. The Jews had been separated from God for centuries at this point. There was no Shekinah glory in the temple when they came back and rebuilt it after the 70 years captivity. Malachi, the last prophet, had ceased speaking two or three centuries before the Maccabees were raised up. To treat the Maccabees as a righteous people and these celebrations for this event that took place when they rededicated the temple as if it was really the Lord working for them is to misjudge the tree. And the tree being something that bears fruit. And when you look at the Hasmonean dynasty that begins back there at the Battle of Panaeum in 198, verse 15, the last descendants of the Hasmonean dynasty are those that in Jesus' day and age were called Pharisees. And by their fruits you shall know them. From beginning to end, this is not anything other than the apostate professed people of God. And to miss that is to miss the symbolism of this line of prophecy that's addressing apostate Protestantism in the glorious land in the last days. This is apostate Judaism in the glorious land during its last days, and it's a symbol of apostate Protestantism in the glorious land of the United States in the last days of history. So in spite of the fact that all the Jews around the world will celebrate Hanukkah and have these wonderful stories about the miracle that took place, part of the history that takes place in our day and age is the manifestation of satanic miracles. And this is just a witness of that history. And I hope to see that as we proceed. They celebrate Hanukkah for an event that took place in 164 BC when they rededicated the temple, which is the same year that Antiochus Epiphanes died. And I often point out that on the 1843 and in the 1850 chart, the only reference on either of those charts that isn't a direct reference to a biblical passage is that both charts identify the death of Antiochus Epiphanes, or maybe just the 1843 chart. I'd have to jump over to the other wall and check the 1850 chart. But in any case, I've always understood that it was an argument from the Millerite history, and it was such a profound argument between the Millerites and the Protestants, because those Protestants of Millerite history would say that Antiochus Epiphanes was the character in verse 14 of Daniel 11 that exalts himself and it falls and that establishes the vision. That was the Protestant position, and the Millerites believed that it was Rome that establishes the vision in Daniel 11 verse 14. And that argument was such a profound argument in the history of the Millerites that the argument made its way onto the chart. And I'm now thinking that you can almost see a biblical reference, although it's a hidden biblical reference, to the death of Antiochus Epiphanes, because in the same year that he died is the same year that they are going to commemorate Hanukkah from that point on. After 164 BC, you come to the League of the Jews, and there's a, I assume it's a typo here, There's three places in Uriah Smith's book, Daniel and Revelation, where he references the league that the Jews formed with Rome in fulfillment of verse 23 of Daniel 11. And one of the references, he cites the year 162. But the other two references, he cites the year 161. And I assume almost all, if not all, of the modern historians tell you that the league with the Jews was 161. So Uriah Smith says, in the same book, 161, he says it twice, and then but one time he says 162. My assumption has always been that there was a typo there that never got caught. But if there's a reason for him to also say 162, I don't know what it is. But that's not really my point. The problem that arises from this position that the modern historians identify the fulfillment of verse 23 of the league with the Jews with Rome as the year 161 BC is that the Millerites on both the charts, the 1843 and the 1850 chart, they cite 158. And so you have on the two charts, you have a blatant disagreement between Millerite understanding and the modern historians, if you want to call them that. But even back in Uriah Smith's day and age, he was using 161. And if you look, if you can find any genuine historical support for 158 in order to support the pioneer Millerite position on 158, I'd like to see it. Because even the references that they cite on the charts for identifying 158 BC as the league with the Jews, I've looked at them and I don't know what kind of logic they were using to pull 158 out for that. But that to me is purposeful on the Lord's part. I want to say that out front. I believe, and you'll see my logic in these notes if you read through, that the league with the Jews is a period of time from 161 to 158. And there's virtually no other way that it could be otherwise than a period of time. Maybe it would be a different period of time, but it had to be a period of time. In that history, if a nation wanted to form a covenant with the power of Rome, they would have to send ambassadors to Rome. When those ambassadors got there, they would have to wait a period of time to get into whatever bureaucracy, the Senate or whatever, was going to hear their request. Then the Romans would have to look at their request, make some changes or accept it as is or put some qualifications upon it. There'd be work that needed to be done. And by the way, you may think that I'm just making this up off the top of my head. This is the historical analysis of the process that went on as Rome formed these covenants with nations around the world. First, the Jews would have to send ambassadors to Rome. They'd have to do their diplomatic interactions in the city of Rome. Then they'd have to return to Judea and confirm with the leaders of the Jews that they were happy with any changes the Romans would have had wanted to make or not make. And then theoretically, they then have to go back to Rome with the signatures of the Jewish leaders to put it in place. So it wasn't something that if you wanted to form a league with the Jews and you thought about it on Monday, that by Tuesday it was all said and done, particularly in that history, because in that history, there was two ways to get to Rome, across the water or the land route. And the land route was slower and more dangerous in terms of bandits and so on and so forth. But the sea route had restrictions because you weren't using motorized boats. You were using wind-driven boats and you were restricted to moving across the Mediterranean based upon the season and the winds and the storms. So it just wasn't a quick process to get this league with the Jews settled. And as I understand it, taking 161, the modern historian's point for the League of the Jews, and the pioneer's point of 158 provides a 2 or 3 year history, depending on when you start in 161 and when you end in 158, that would be consistent with the process of entering into a league with the Jews. And the point about this is that I think it's challenging in the sense that in order for my application of this to be valid, it requires that you accept the modern historian's application while accepting the Millerite application, even though at a basic level they seem to contradict one another, but using both of them, they form a period of time. And then my argument is that the period of time that they form is a prophetic symbol of a period of time when the image of the beast is formed in the United States, leading up to the Sunday law of verse 16 or verse 41. And Sister White informs us that the great test for the people of God is the formation of the image of the beast. It is the test that we must pass before we were sealed. It's the test that we must pass before probation closes. And I've understood that since 9/11, the image of the beast test is underway, and I believe that fully. But I also believe that 9/11, September 11th, 2001, began the sealing of the 144,000, and that the prophetic characteristics that are associated with September 11th, 2001 are all repeated at the very ending period of the sealing of the 144,000. And in that period, you have the actual nuts and bolts, the really work of setting up of church and state coming together in the United States. And I'm understanding that this period of the League of the Jews addresses that. So I've given you an overview of the dates. And now I will go back to page one, but I would read through some of the logic for me making these claims. And you'll notice that the title on your notes is Caesarea Philippi. And Uriah Smith will tell you that after Ptolemy won the Battle of Raphia, and then he attempted to make sacrifice at the temple in Jerusalem, and was the traditional view is that God intervened and prevented him from doing so. And in his anger and frustration, he returned to Egypt and persecuted the Jews there, especially the Jews in Alexandria, where I think 12,000 of them are noted as being put to death by him. And the verse says he was not strengthened by his victory at Raphia. And ultimately, he parties and drinks himself to death and turns his kingdom comes under the control of this five-year-old son. And at that point, the Seleucid Empire that he had beaten in Raphia forms an alliance with Philip of Macedon, which this alliance is referenced in verse 13. This alliance also can be seen in the name Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea being named after Caesar, And my son has corrected me on how to pronounce Caesarea. It's Caesarea, okay? He listens to these books on tapes by these persons that know grammar better than I, and it's Caesarea, but I'm gonna have a hard time remembering that. Anyway, the name of Paneum was changed by Herod Philippi, and he changed it to give, he named the city after he rededicated it, remodeled it, fixed it up in his time period, to name it after Caesar and himself, Philippi. And so you see this name alliance here that has an echo of the story of Paneum. And the story of Paneum is the story of verses 13, 14, and 15 that begins with an alliance in verse 13 of the Seleucid Empire and the Macedonian Empire, that they're going to conquer the Egyptian child king and divide up the land according to their, which land was closer to each of their domains. But in verse 14, Uriah Smith says, now I'm going to read from your notes from Daniel Revelation 2:56, a new power is now introduced, the robbers of thy people, literally, says Bishop Newton, the breakers of thy people. Far away on the banks of the Tiber, a kingdom had been nourishing itself with ambitious projects and dark designs. Small and weak at first, it grew with marvelous rapidity and strength and vigor, reaching out cautiously here and there to try its prowess and test the vigor of its warlike arm, till conscious of its power, it boldly reared its head among the nations of the earth and seized with invincible hand the helm of their affairs. Henceforth, the name Rome stands upon the historic page, destined for long ages to come to control the affairs of the world and exert a mighty influence among the nations, even to the end of time. Rome spoke, and Syria and Macedonia soon found a change coming over the aspect of their dream. This is the Seleucids and Philip of Macedon that were going to conquer this child Egyptian king. Rome spoke, and the Syrians and Macedonians soon found a change coming over the aspect of their dream. The Romans interfered in behalf of the young king of Egypt, determined that he should be protected from the ruin devised by Antiochus and Philip. This was BC 200, and was one of the first important inferences of the Romans in the affairs of Syria and Egypt. And this was written by Uriah Smith, and I just don't know what to make of it, because it's 200 BC, and he's going to argue strongly later on that Rome, that a power is not introduced into history until it comes in contact with God's people, and he's going to say that contact was with the League of the Jews in 161, yet he's clearly identifying that Rome's in the prophetic narrative 39 years before that, in 200 BC. The issue here for me what I see in this is that after the Ukraine war is finished, Putin is not going to be benefited by this, and he's going to come to his end, and his kingdom's going to get left, not necessarily to a five-year-old child, but the history of that is that this five-year-old child in Egyptian history had a Egyptian protector over him, and that protector was so arrogant and controlling that he gets assassinated trying to push his agenda, and from there the Egyptian political structure began to crumble. And so this is what's illustrated in that history, suggesting that that's what's going to happen in Russia after the victory in Ukraine. And Macedon, Philip of Macedon, Macedon is the word for Macedonia, and Macedonia is Greece. So I'm suggesting that the Seleucid Empire was the king of the north, and that Macedon is Greece, and in our day and age, the king of the north, the proxy army of the king of the north, that's going to set its sights upon the booty of a dissolving Russian empire is the King of the North, the United States, and the United Nations, Greece, the world empire, and they're going to be deciding how they're going to benefit from the collapse of Russia. And it's at this point that Papal Rome is going to lift itself up, as the great defender of Mother Russia, or whatever, somehow going to insert herself into that history in advance of the soon coming Sunday law. And in doing so, this is where she begins to sing her songs in fulfillment of Isaiah 23. The whore of Tyre is forgotten for 70 years, is the days of one king, and the days of that one kingdom that the whore of Tyre is forgotten is the history of the United States from 1798 until the Sunday law. And just as we're approaching the Sunday law in verse 16 of Daniel 11, in verse 14, the papacy begins to sing her songs, and her songs are her experience and her proclivity to commit fornication with the kings of the earth. She's going to come in and offer her services to solve the problems that are brought upon the world with the collapse of Russia, and she's going to hold off NATO and the United States from dealing with Russia. So this alliance of the Seleucid Empire and Macedon that was ready to jump on the Egyptian king is typifying the alliance of the United States and the United Nations. It's ready to move into a collapsing Russia. Papacy intercedes. And the next verse, verse 15, is the Battle of Panium. Let me read from this next part. This isn't Smith, this is me. Rome is first introduced into the prophetic narrative in the year 200 BC, and their introduction there is the most significant reference of Rome in all of Daniel, for it is the very verse that defines Rome as the symbol that establishes the vision. Smith teaches otherwise, and the reason I say Smith teaches otherwise is what I've already mentioned. He says that a power isn't mentioned in prophecy until it comes into contact with God's people. But Smith doesn't believe that Rome came into contact with God's people in the year 200. So he looks to the year 161. And for me, I'm saying that Rome came into the prophetic narrative in the year 200. And when it did so in fulfillment of verse 14, there is no more important verse in Daniel 11, or perhaps in prophecy, than verse 14 of Daniel 11, because it's saying that the prophetic vision is established by the subject of Rome. So Rome's being introduced here in the most profound way that it could possibly be. And therefore, I disagree with Smith's logic. They came in the year 200, and they come in before the Sunday law. And I'm understanding that where Smith is going to place them, at the league with the Jews in 161. First off, I would disagree with Smith and the other historians. The league with the Jews is not a point in time, a point in time being, as they claim, 161. I believe that to square up with the charts, which Sister White says is directed by the hand of the Lord and should not be altered, that the league with the Jews represents a period of time, 161 to 158. And the point that I'm making here is that 158 would correspond to the Sunday law, and that the 161 marks the final movements of the setting up of the image of the beast in the United States from 161 to 158. And Rome gets introduced into the history before that, because she's coming out of her 70 years of being forgotten and she's beginning to sing her songs. And this is the characteristic of the papacy. I'm going to read here again, my words, not Smith's. Rome's purposeful influence in that history identifies the work of Jezebel, a symbol of a church that pulls strings from behind the scenes. Jezebel was home in Samaria when her husband Ahab watched her prophets get slain by Elijah. Herodias was not at Herod's birthday party where her daughter Salome seduced Herod. In the history of the United States, the papacy represented as by the whore of Tyre is forgotten until the end of the symbolic 70 years. She then begins to sing her songs of deception to the king of the earth. The year 200 BC typifies when she begins to openly sing to the kings in the last days, just before the soon coming Sunday law represented in verse 16. 2 years after she's introduced into history, you have the Battle of Panium. And I contend that the Battle of Panium, although it's not a battle between the king of the north and the king of the south, it's a battle that's more about religious, between two apostate religions, the wokeism of the United Nations, the New Age, spiritualism, however you want to define the religion of the one worlders, versus the apostate Protestantism of the United States that's been typified by the apostate Maccabeism of literal Judah. The United States being spiritual Judah, literal Judah has apostate Maccabeanism, if that's a real word, that is typifying apostate Protestantism. And the Battle of Panium is about that struggle. And in 198 BC, the Battle of Panium, which occurred 19 years after Raphia in 198, was also known as the Battle of Mount Panium or the Battle of Panias. It was between the Seleucid Empire led by King Antiochus III the Great and the Hasmonean rebels led by Judas Maccabeus. This battle took place during the Maccabean struggle against the Seleucid Empire's attempts to suppress Jewish religious practices and impose Hellenistic culture. Judas Maccabee and his forces achieved the decisive victory over the Seleucid army at Panium. I'm saying that in the history after the Ukrainian war, the history that's approaching the setting up of the image of the beast, because the final movements are rapid ones. They're not these decades apart as this ancient history was that fulfilled these verses. In the Battle of Panium, it's going to conclude with the Battle of Actium. I've lost it for a moment. I'm taking some things for granted with this listening audience that it may not be fair to some of those of you that haven't been following this message very long, but when Rome takes control of the world, she first has to conquer three geographical areas. Pagan Rome conquers the three geographical areas beginning in verse 16 of Daniel 11 through verse 19. Uriah Smith tells us that in verse 16, Syria was conquered by the Romans in 65 BC. And in the same verse, the Romans conquered Jerusalem for the first time in 63 BC. And then verses 17 through 19 talk about Julius Caesar going into Egypt and conquering the third geographical obstacle of Egypt. And that battle with Egypt ended with the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. And when before Rome takes control as the premier ruling power, it has to overcome three geographical obstacles, those are represented in verses 16 through 19 of Daniel 11, but they're also represented in Daniel 8, verse 19, where pagan Rome is identified as conquering the east, the south, and the pleasant land, the east being Syria, the south being Egypt, and the pleasant land being Judah, as is illustrated also in verses 16 through 19. Once Rome has conquered the three geographical areas, it rules the world supremely. And in Daniel 11, verse 24, speaking of pagan Rome, it identifies that Rome would rule the world for a time, and a time in Bible prophecy is 306 years. And that 360 years began at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, and it ended in the year 330 when Constantine divided the Roman Empire into East and West by moving the capital of the empire from the city of Rome to the city of Constantinople. From that point on, it was impossible for Rome to be ruled well because the capital had been moved too far out of the center point. With papal Rome as a second witness to what I'm trying to suggest here, and what I'm trying to suggest here is that for Rome to take control of the world, it first has to conquer three geographical areas. For papal Rome to take control of the world and rule for 1260 years, three horns had to be plucked up in Daniel chapter 7, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals. And when the third of those three horns, the Goths, were driven out of the city of Rome in 538, then Rome ruled the world supremely for 360 years. So pagan Rome and papal Rome provide two witnesses about modern Rome. And modern Rome's deadly wound is healed at the soon coming Sunday Law, where the threefold union of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet is accomplished in the verses we're studying. That is verse 16. And it's also verse 41 of Daniel 11. At that Sunday Law, there is a period of time where the persecution is going to be accomplished by the papacy. They're going to rule the world supremely once again. So the beginning of them ruling the world supremely at the end of the world has been typified by the Battle of Actium. The Battle of Actium is the Sunday Law. It's the Sunday Law, verse 41. It's the Sunday Law, verse 16. And what I'm suggesting is that the Battle of Panaeum in verse 15 leads to the Battle of Actium, and that the Battle of Actium is the Third World War. This third battle of the, what I'm calling the Cold War, from verses 10 through 15 of Daniel 11, lead in to the Third World War that starts when the hour of the great earthquake of Revelation 11 arrives, as the ensign of the 144,000 are being lifted up, and as chapter 11 of Revelation 11 states, behold, the third woe cometh quickly, and the seventh trumpet sound, and the nations were angry. At the Sunday Law, the Third World War begins right where national apostasy is followed by national ruin. And verse 15's Panaeum is what leads to that. Between this battle, during this battle of Panaeum and the Sunday Law, between it, you also have the year 164, where the apostate Maccabees have this rededication of the temple, cleaned it up, and they have this miracle of the oil going 8 days, which is one day's supply. So I'm suggesting that in the aftermath of 198 and the Battle of Panaeum, miracles are going to begin. There's going to be some kind of miraculous restoration, satanic miracle that restores the confidence of apostate Protestantism within the idea that they really are God's chosen people. And then 3 years later in this narrative, in 161, the process of formally bringing together church and state in the United States, leading to the Sunday Law of 158, is underway. I'm on page two of the notes, and I'm going to read from my notes. And this is where the Maccabean revolt begins. They've been in a war against the Seleucid Empire since at least the Battle of Paneum in 198. But the historians say the revolt begins at the battle, or at Modium, which is the town. And I'll read the history there under 167 BC in your notes. The Maccabean revolt was sparked by the efforts of Matthias, the Jewish priest, and his five sons, particularly Judah Maccabee, to resist the Hellenization imposed by the Seleucid ruler Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. This is the infamous Antiochus Epiphanes that the Protestant say established his vision in fulfillment of team. He had that very year. This was the debate that the Millerites, one of the premier debates that the Millerites had with the Protestants of their day and age. The Millerites say, no, it was Rome that establishes the vision that exalts itself and that falls in fulfillment of verse 14. And the Protestants were saying, no, it's this infamous Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes from this very history. And he dies in 164 in this very history that they begin this revolt. So I'll read on. These policies of trying to Hellenize the Jewish religious system, these policies included attempts to suppress Jewish religious practices and force the adoption of Greek customs and beliefs. The catalyst for the revolt was an incident in the village of Modin, where Matthias refused to comply with a decree to offer a sacrifice to a Greek deity. Modin is derived from the Hebrew word modia, which means to declare or to protest. In his protest, Matthias killed a Jewish apostate who was about to perform the sacrifice, and he and his sons fled to the hills, initiating a guerrilla warfare campaign against the Seleucid forces. The Maccabean revolt lasted for several years, during which the Maccabees engaged in numerous battles against the Seleucids and their allies. Despite being vastly outnumbered and out-equipped, the Maccabees achieved several significant victories. What I'm hoping you'll see here is that their revolt in 167, okay, I hope I wasn't saying 164, 164 is 3 years later, or 4 years later, of course. This revolt begins in Modin, and I don't think it's an accident that the town Modin, that the name Modin means to protest or declare, because the revolt that the Maccabeans are accomplishing here is to protest against a false religion, and they're typifying apostate Protestantism. And in this protest, it's to be noted, and history brings this out, that the Maccabees didn't just initiate a guerrilla warfare against the Seleucid Empire, which they did, but they also initiated a warfare against the Jews that they understood to be supportive of Greece. They were, in their minds, they were apostates. So they had an internal war going on amongst themselves and an external war with the Greek religions that was being imposed. And this little detail speaks to the political religious struggle of the two horns of the earth beast in this very time period. Okay. Are you a liberal Christian or a conservative Christian? Are you a Democrat or a Republican? And the Democrats, the political manifestation in the United States today, they're globalists. And so are the Rhino Republicans. They're globalists. And their counterpart, the MAGA-ism group of Donald Trump, they're anti-globalists. And this struggle is represented in the struggle of the Maccabees to not only resist the religion of globalism in the broad sense, but also resist those within their own nation that are promoting and supporting what they consider to be rebellion. And the idea that it all began at the town that is called Modin, which means to declare a protest. It's just amazing how the Lord has controlled the flow of history. Next paragraph. The Seleucid Empire was seeking to impose the religion of Greece upon the Jews, and the Greek represent the globalism of the last days. Their religion is expressed in the wokeism that is currently being forced upon the United States and the world by the globalist forces of the banking system, the mainstream media, and the educational centers, and the tearing down of national distinctions through the forced immigration of illegal aliens. When Antiochus Epiphanes was forcing the Greek religion upon the Jews, there were Jews who were cooperating with his efforts. The Maccabees represent one class of apostate Jews who were resisting the religion of Greece, but there was also another class of apostate Jews who were supporting the work of enforcing the Greek religion. This warfare between within apostate Protestantism, having two classes within apostate Protestantism that oppose one another, can be easily demonstrated. But it's the same way with the Republican horn in the United States. There's two classes of the Republican horn. There's the globalists, Democrats, and the followers of Trump, the MAGA group, and liberal, conservative, however you want to define it, it's part of the dynamics of this prophetic sequence of events that we're in. Going to 164 now, 164 is the time, the year that this Antiochus Epiphanes, that's on the 1843 chart that really has no reference in the scriptures to justify him being on there, except as you begin to see that he died in this year that they celebrate Hanukkah. And from that point on, the historians say the Seleucid Empire is just, if not disintegrating, but it's losing its influence and dropping off into history. So there's something about his death corresponding with the rededication of the temple that is called Hanukkah in Judaism today, that is a waymark in our history. It's the rededication of the temple and Donald Trump and the apostate Protestants of the United States somehow thoroughly and fully prevailing over the religion of globalism in the United States, at which point, look out. Once under 164, I'm going to read here, the rededication of the second temple in Jerusalem, which marks the historical event celebrated during Hanukkah, occurred in approximately 164 BC, 3 years before the League of verse 23. This event followed the successful military campaign of the Maccabees against the forces of the Seleucid Empire, led by the infamous Antiochus Epiphanes, who had desecrated the temple and outlawed Jewish religious practices. Antiochus Epiphanes died shortly after the victory that is commemorated by Hanukkah and marks the descent of Syrian power from that point onward in history. After reclaiming Jerusalem and the temple, the Maccabees cleansed the temple of the pagan defilements and restored it to its proper religious use. According to tradition, they found only a single cruse of consecrated oil, enough to light the menorah for one day. However, miraculously, the oil lasted for 8 days until more oil could be prepared. This miracle of the oil burning for 8 days is central to the celebration of Hanukkah, As a result, Hanukkah, also known as the Festival of Lights, is celebrated for 8 days to commemorate the rededication of the temple and the miracle of the holy oil. In this struggle that is being outlined in this history of verses 13 to verse 16 between the Maccabees and the globalist religion, these waymarks are in history, and they correspond to waymarks that are going to be in our history. There will come a point as we approach the Sunday law when Donald Trump has subdued those that have been opposing him since 2015, and probably is aligning with the point in history where the religious leaders of the United States are crying out that we need to return to God in order to forestall these judgments that are in the land and return this country to temporal prosperity. And there's going to be some kind of miracle at that point in time that has been prefigured by this miracle at Hanukkah and the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. And I'm making that point because the setting up of the image of the beast, which is yet going to start 3 years later in 161, the setting up of the image of the beast at the very end of the sealing time of the 144,000 is like a micro of the whole sealing time of the 144,000 that begin in that 9/11 and goes until the Sunday law. And Jesus illustrates the end with the beginning, and the test and the light that he brought at 9/11, he brings again at the very end. And this period at the end, among other things, is where the image of the beast is raised up. It was being raised up since 9/11, but here's where the laws are going to be starting to be enacted in the United States and enforce the Sunday laws that lead to the Sunday law. And the image of the beast testing time in the United States typifies the image of the beast testing time in the world. At the Sunday law, the United States is going to go to the world and force them to set up an image of the beast. So the characteristics that take place in the world when the United States is forcing the world to set up an image of the beast in fulfillment of verses 14 through 18 of Revelation 13, what's going on in the world has already been typified in the setting up of the image of the beast in the United States. And therefore, at the Sunday law in the United States, when the work of setting up the world image of the beast begins, Sister White tells us at the Sunday law decree, then we know that the time has come for the marvelous working of Satan and that the end is near. Therefore, in the setting up of the image of the beast in the United States, there reaches a point where satanic miracles are going to enter in to this testing process. And I'm suggesting that this miracle of Hanukkah in 164 that's accomplished for not righteous Jews, but for the Maccabean Jews, who in the time of Christ are going to be the Pharisees, that this is marking when Satan is going to begin to really manifest some type of deception in conjunction with them restoring the worship of God in the country, rededicating the temple. Sister White says that there is a series of Sunday laws that leads to the Sunday law that fulfills Bible prophecy, and the Sunday law that fulfills Bible prophecy is the Sunday law that forces you to observe Sunday and persecutes you for keeping Sabbath. And before that Sunday law arrives, which is verse 16 of Daniel 11 or verse 41 of Daniel 11, there's going to be some legislation that begins to develop and grow. And that is the setting up of the image of the beast And I'm arguing that the history of the setting up of the image of the beast is typified by the period of 161 to 158 of the League of the Jews, a period of time. And before 161, 3 years before that, in 164, the miracle of Hanukkah took place and the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. And it's a waymark that says that at that point, the United States is going to be confronted not only with the judgments of God, but with some kind of singular miracle, if not many miracles, that are typifying the miracles that take place at the Sunday Law during the image of the beast testing process for the world. So I'm now in my notes where it says 161 BC unto 158. I'll read through this. Some of it's Uriah Smith, some of it's me. Let me check the time here. Before the League of the Jews in 161 to 158, the Maccabees have achieved their Hanukkah victory in 164. Then 3 years later, still in an ongoing struggle with the Syrians, the Maccabeans, Jews reach out to Rome for support. The League with Rome that was then formed becomes a prophetic test for God's people, last day students of prophecy. History identifies, when I say it's a prophetic test, I think it's, the reason I'm saying it becomes a prophetic test is this. Modern historians and even Uriah Smith say the League of the Jews was 161. But God, through Ellen White, says that the 1843 chart was directed by the hand of the Lord and should not be altered. And on the 1850 chart, that God was in the publishing of the 1850 chart. And both of those represent the League of the Jews of 158. So you're being tested. Is 161 right or is 158 right? I'm suggesting that the way to resolve that problem, and I'm not trying to look for a way to get around a problem. I'm saying the way that the problem is resolved is recognizing that it's a period of time that's typifying the setting up of the image of the beast. But it's a test because you're going to have to decide whether you're going to take the date 158 that the Millerites held to without really a great deal of historical, if any, justification for doing so. And what I find significant about that is 161 to 158 typifying the image of the beast testing time, that is the great test for the people of God. So for a student of prophecy to be tested by the history and the possible discrepancy by the historians on the very history that illustrates the great test for the people of God, I think it's a pretty profound parallel. Is it a parallel? But it's, I don't think it's accidental. Okay, so in the notes under 161 BC, 161 BC, you can see Uriah Smith's comment about how Rome is only identified when it first becomes connected with the people of God. And I'm suggesting it became connected with the people of God in the year 200, even though it was inserting itself only into the history of the Seleucids and the Syrians and the Egyptians, that it is definitely pointing forward to our day and age when it begins to papal Rome begins to insert itself into this history, and that I don't know why Uriah Smith don't connect that. And then you have in your notes the three places where Uriah Smith marks the League of the Jews 161, and you can look at that. And then on page 4 under the League, you can read my take on, which I've already given you, on the process of negotiating a league in that history. It just wasn't anything that could be done in 1 year's time. And therefore, you have justification for understanding it as a process. And so So I'm going to drop to the last page of your notes, where it says verse 16, which is the Sunday law, and try to begin wrapping this up. Daniel 11 first identifies how Rome politically takes control, and then Daniel repeats and enlarges upon the same history with identifying how Rome deals with God's people in the very same history. From verses 16 to 19, the three obstacles of pagan Rome taking control of the world are illustrated. In verse 16, Syria was conquered by pagan Rome in 65 BC, and then Judah was conquered by Pompey in 63 BC. When Pompey conquers Jerusalem in 63 BC, it's illustrating the papacy conquering the United States at the Sunday Law. And Uriah Smith will tell you that when Pompey conquered Jerusalem, that there was a civil war going on in Jerusalem in 63 BC. And I'm going to read now. Uriah Smith stated on Pompey's return from his expedition to Mithridates, king of Pontus, two competitors, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, were struggling for the crown of Judea. The names Hyrcanus and Aristobulus are both Greek origin and have historical significance, particularly in the context of Jewish history during the Hellenistic period and the Hasmonean dynasty. Hyrcanus' name is derived from the Greek word Hyrcanos, which likely originated from the word Hyrcan, meaning wolf in the Persian language. Hyrcanus was a name borne by several Hasmonean rulers. Aristobulus means best counselor or best advisor. Aristobulus was another name borne by several Hasmonean rulers. Both Hyrcanus and Aristobulus are names associated with significant figures in Jewish history during the Hasmonean period. What I'm wanting you to see is the historians identify that when Pompey conquered Jerusalem in 63 BC, which is illustrating the papacy conquering the United States, spiritual Jerusalem, spiritual Judah, at the Sunday Law, that there's a controversy going on between two classes of apostate Protestants, one represented by this Hyrcanus and the other by Aristobulus. And it's speaking to the fact that both the Republican horn and the Protestant horn are going to be wrapped up in a civil war during this period of time. It's one of the things that will confront Donald Trump, because as the last Republican president, Donald Trump was typified by the first Republican president. And the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, was preceded by a Democratic president called Buchanan, which historians will tell you was the worst ineffective president up to Abraham Lincoln. There had never been one like it. Thus, Buchanan was typifying Biden, who is definitely the worst president in American history. And it was Buchanan that opened up, brought about the Civil War, and it is Biden that is producing this Civil War that's underway in the United States. And in verse 16 of the soon coming Sunday Law, when Rome does conquer the United States, it will find that this war, this nation, the United States, has been divided into two classes, both politically, the Republican horn, and spiritually, the Protestant horn. And that's a story a little bit further down the line. Now, I'm closing this study now, and what I want to remind you, though, before I do what I'm setting forth. I'm arguing that the portion of the prophecy of Daniel that relates to the last days that was sealed up is the hidden history of verse 40, from the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 until the Sunday Law in Daniel 11, verse 41. And I'm arguing that verses 1 and 2 of Daniel 11 illustrate a history that begins at 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and goes to at least 2020, but at minimum to 2015, when the sixth richest president is introduced into this prophetic history, and he stirs up begins the agitation that accomplishes the separation of the globalists against Donald Trump, against Make America Great Again. It ends there. It jumps, verse 2 jumps right on into Alexander the Great, and there's a period there that's left blank. But then when you get to verse 10, you once again are brought to 1989, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then verses 11 and 12 are identifying the Ukrainian war, the Russian victory, and the aftermath and demise of Putin. Verse 13 takes up that history by identifying the desire of the United Nations and the United States to take advantage of Russia's weakness. But the papacy then begins to sing her song, and she inserts herself into history as the great fornicator of the kings of the earth to solve these political problems. And it leads to verse 15, which is this Battle of Panem, but the Battle of Panem is the struggle primarily between the apostate Protestants and the apostate religion of Pan, of the globalist religion. And that war, that battle, culminates in the Battle of Actium, which is the Sunday law and the beginning of the papacy's time to rule supremely during the second papal bloodbath. That history that we've laid over the top of those verses with this story of the Maccabeans and my identification of them as apostate Judaism that symbolizes apostate Protestantism, very little of it is actually directly identified in the scriptures, but it's soundly identified in history. And therefore, I'm saying it gets plugged into this hidden history of verse 40. And I'm saying that that is a platform to understand what Jesus does when he takes the disciples to Caesarea Philippi, which is Panem. It's just the name of Panem in his day and age was Caesarea Philippi. There's no way that Jesus doesn't understand, didn't plan, didn't make this happen, that the testimony that he gives at Caesarea Philippi is to be laid right over the top of the verses 13 to 15 of Daniel 11. And until you have this sequence of events of the year 200 BC, the year 198 BC, 167 BC, 164 BC, 161 to 158 BC, until you can see that flow of events as a structure to place the testimony of Matthew 16 and 17 over the top, it's not quite as strong, but it needs to be strong because it's in Matthew 16 and 17 where Jesus identifies the final sealing of the 144,000. He plainly identifies that Peter is confessing the message of the 144,000. And we needed to see that before we take up Matthew 16 and Matthew 17. So I will end there.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
My question is about the interaction after Russia is weakened. He's engaged in war, but he is not, and he has victory, but he's not strengthened by it. And then the interaction of Rome at that time, the papacy, I'm wondering if it does anywhere in there, does the fact that Russia, it wasn't, so I think it was about a year ago, Russia did dedicate, Putin did dedicate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. It didn't really make a lot of news. We never really discussed it a lot. But I did come across that. I believe it was a year ago, just within the last year. And I wonder, does that enter into it anywhere? Like, is there a bond of sympathy between Rome and Russia as a result of that? I don't know. It's just a bit of a loose end there. Just wondering if there's any comment on that.
Well, I agree with that logic. That's when we were writing about the much of the leadership in the Ukraine being Nazis in the articles, we found that even in the liberal press that is supportive of the Ukraine and is willing to label the MAGA Trump people as Nazis, they can't deny that there is a large influence of Nazis in the Ukraine. It's just the fact that it's too big to be noticed and that not noticed. So our historical references were the people that you would expect who would be opposed to that idea. So what I was saying is that clearly, the proxy army for the papacy in World War II were the Nazis. My abundant evidence of that. The proxy army in the collapse of the Soviet Union was the United States. And in Ukraine, the proxy army for the papacy, once again, to accomplish her work is the same proxy army she used in World War II. And not so long ago, the Ukrainian government has been pretty aggressive against the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. So, in Revelation, or not Revelation, in Isaiah chapter 4, verse 1, there is a verse that is part of the work of the papacy. And if you go to the Seventh-day Adventist Bible commentary, although I realize they have printed a new one. And I don't care to look at what that might say, but they taught the standard Protestant view, of course, and it was wrong. And in verse 1 of Isaiah 4 says, "And in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, 'We will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel, only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach.'" Protestants and Adventism teach that this is this man that the women are taking hold of is Christ, and there's no way if you take hold of Christ, you don't wear your own apparel. Okay, it's this is the papacy, and so what I'm saying is in the story of the papacy returning to the throne of the earth, there's a work that the papacy accomplishes that it brings all the churches back under its authority, and one of the greatest isms, as they call it, in Catholic history was the breaking away of the Orthodox churches, which are in Eastern Europe, the Orthodox Church in Ukraine and Russia. So when I looked at the papacy interceding into this history to protect Russia, that's what I was understanding, is that it's doing a work. It could care less about Russia. It's trying to bring the Orthodox churches that separated from the Roman Church in the year 1000, I think, back into the fold of Catholicism in fulfillment of this verse, because it's seven women that take hold of the papacy. In this time period, all these apostate churches are going to come back together under her umbrella. But that's not a subject that I'm a real expert on. I don't know a great deal about
Okay. No, I
Orthodox religion.
appreciate that perspective of the Orthodox religion. That does make sense. And this is another thing we haven't really talked about a lot in our studies, but when Pope Francis came in, and I just want your take on this as well, when he became the Pope, I think one of the first things he did, either 2013 or 2014, was travel to Cuba to meet with the leader of the Eastern Orthodox Church religion and sign some kind of an agreement, a treaty of some kind with him. So that would make sense. What you're saying is that's something that he's trying to protect because they're allied with him now, with Rome.
I think that's what it, that, I think that has something to do with it. So he's protecting his flock at that point.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Hey, Brother Larry.
Hi. I had a question on when you were talking about the three geographical locations that were conquered. You seem to correlate, and I think is accurate, Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. In Daniel 8, would you say that the East, the South, and the Pleasant Land is Islam, Russia, and the USA? And then that's one question. And then, are you familiar with Alexander Dugin? My understanding is he's considered Putin's brain. He's kind of a spiritual leader of sorts in Russia. And yeah, those are my questions.
Well, I don't know anything about Alexander Dugin, so I can't help you there. The East, South, and Pleasant Land. I get what you're saying, but I don't think so. I think the three obstacles can't include Islam, because Islam, and I mean this is a subject that I think you have to be real specific about. Islam, as the pioneers correctly identified it, is the judgment that was raised up by God to chastise an apostate church. Okay, and Islam remains the same all the way to the end. Islam is the tool of God's judgment against Catholicism all the way through and Catholicism structure. So I don't think you can identify it. The papacy is conquering Islam. But when the papacy is brought down in Revelation 17, the 10 kings are going to burn her with fire and eat her flesh. So the United Nations has something to do with bringing her down, but so too does Islam, because her financial structure for her support is swept away by an east wind destroying the ships of Tarshish. So it would be hard for me to see that it is one of the three geographical obstacles, Islam, even though I get what you're saying about East.
Yeah. So who would you plug in? Who do you see as
I stick to what we've always taught, is that the first obstacle was the Soviet Union in 1989. The second obstacle is the United States and Egypt at the soon coming Sunday Law, Egypt being the United Nations.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. I agree with that too. Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Would you close our meeting with a prayer for us?
Yes. First off, everybody have a good Sabbath, what's left of it.
Thank you.
Should we pray?
Yeah.
Heavenly Father, thank you for this Sabbath day. We thank you for the light that you're unsealing for us here at the end of time. We ask that you give us discernment that we can recognize that these crazy events that are taking place on planet Earth, and these horrible events, these wars, rumors of wars, would only give us the motivation to look up, because we know that our redemption is drawing nigh, and would not beat us down to where we can't be used by you to give a warning to those that need to be warned. Thank you for being in attendance today and watching over the technical part of the internet. We ask a blessing upon the rest of this day in Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.